If not, Representative Lippert, would you care to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the minutes.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Next on the agenda is House File 769. And I will move that House File 769 be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. We have the bill before us. Representative Carlson, you may proceed, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the bill deals with the Public Employee Relations Board and the Bureau of Mediation. And we passed legislation a few years ago that established the board, and the bill that is before you would, in the simplest way to describe it, would be there's some housekeeping language in it and an appropriation. And it would require, when it ultimately gets to Ways and Means, a $435,000 appropriation each year. So those are the two main reasons that it's here, but I have two witnesses that will testify to the need of the bill. But the one thing I do want to point out, when we're dealing with, and I should have mentioned unfair labor practices, when we're dealing with unfair labor practices currently, when we're dealing with the public sector, it ends up in the courts, and that's a very expensive process. So by using the board, per board, it's a less costly provision. And when we originally passed the bill, we had both the unions, the employee groups, and management testifying in favor of the bill because of the cost savings. So with that, I'm not sure which. You want to go first, Jonathan? Sure. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Please proceed.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the InterFaculty Organization. We are a union that represents approximately 4,000 professors, coaches, librarians, and counselors at the seven Minnesota State Universities. I'm also in front of you today representing a broad coalition of public employee unions in support of the full implementation of the Public Employment Relations Board. With the full implementation of PERB, employees have an accessible forum to challenge unfair labor practices. As Representative Carlson said, the current court process is prohibitively costly and can take far too long to find a resolution. A brief list of our coalition partners include Law Enforcement Labor Services, Education Minnesota, the Minnesota AFL-CIO, AFSCME Council 65, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, the Minnesota Nurses Association, Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 1005, International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 70, the IFO, the Middle Management Association, the Minnesota School Employees Association, AFSCME Council 5, Teamsters Local 320, Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota, SEIU, the Minnesota Government Engineering Council, and others. I just want to say that PERB creates an accessible forum to challenge ULP unfair labor practices. We urge you to make sure the process is adequately funded to offer meaningful remedies. The creation of the PERB was a significant step forward in bringing the protection of PELRA to employees, and it is extremely important that the PERB is successful. Thanks for your support.
And, Thank you. Do we have another testifier?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I might just point out one additional thing is that this is a process. When we had the bill up a few years ago, we pointed out that several other states use this process as well. So it's not a unique process. It's got a little history around the country.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Moving on.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I currently serve as the chair of the Public Employment Relations Board. The board was created during the 2014 legislative session, essentially to process and decide charges of unfair labor practices under the Public Employment Labor Relations Act, or PELRA. The PERB is made up of three members and three alternate members. One member and one alternate represent public employers. One member and one alternate represent public employees. And one member and one alternate represent the public at large. The PERB was initially allocated $125,000 as part of its creation to become operational and essentially develop the rules that it needed to become operational. We have done that in the meantime. But to actually conduct the business that is mandated in the statute, it will need additional resources. And that is why we are here asking for additional funding. So the members of the PIRB ask that this committee support the appropriation in this bill, which is an additional $435,000 per year. The members believe that this is the budget that is necessary to cover the anticipated costs that are mandated by the statute. As Representative Carlson said, the PIRB was patterned after other state agencies. In fact, of the 35 states that recognize unfair labor practices, 32 of them have agencies, have an administrative process that is similar to the one that was enacted here. So as of July 1st of 2020, the PIRB is statutorily mandated to investigate all ULPs that are filed, issue complaints when it's determined that the ULP charges have a basis in law or fact, conduct hearings in front of hearing officers, and issue decisions on appeals of those hearing officer decisions. And in order to do that, the PIRB will need to hire additional staff, well, hire staff, contract with hearing officers for hearings, and over hearings that warrant a complaint. And if it's the PIRB runs out of money and is unable to do that, it will definitely be the basis for litigation. And more importantly, people who have been harmed by unfair labor practice will not have a forum in which to address that. So in addition to the funding request, we're also proposing legislative amendments to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act and the Open Meeting Law. These changes are critical to the operation of the board. So the language will provide clear guidance on what happens to the data that is in the hands of the board. So individuals that are filing or defending unfair labor practices will know what classification the data will have when it is given to the board. And finally, it exempts the PIRB from the open meeting law under very specific circumstances, such as deliberations on cases. We're a three-member board, so when any two of us are in one location, we have an open meeting law requirement. And for the deliberation of cases, similar to how the Court of Appeals panel of three judges, the deliberations we're asking be exempted from the open meeting law. So that's essentially a summary of the bill.
Thank you. I understand we have a couple of amendments to address. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we have, first of all, the A1.
Proceed, please.
I move the A1. Thank you.
The A1 amendment has been moved. Discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, and the reason I'm offering this amendment is because I have real concerns that money could be that we're not really adhering to separation of powers. And the reason I bring that up is that if you look at the composition of the board, two of the people are appointed by the governor, and the third person is appointed by the governor's appointee, all in the executive branch. Yet if the board came to the conclusion that damages should be awarded, they become the responsibility of the legislature to appropriate. The money has to come from someplace. So the reason for the amendment is that the appointments would have to be confirmed by a majority vote of the Senate so that at least the legislature, who is the ultimate appropriating body, has some say in the way the board is going to be run.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would respectfully request a no vote on the bill. I do find it rather interesting that motion is made in a House committee to turn the appointment process over to the Senate. But that's another separation of powers issue, I guess. But I would encourage a no vote because I think we've got a good system in place the way the bill was originally drafted.
Understood.
I don't know if either witness has any comments.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
I should add that all decisions of the PIRB are appealable to the Court of Appeals, directly to the Court of Appeals. So I don't know if that helps with that question.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I go back to the idea, first of all, separation, and then also on bias. I mean, we've got the executive branch appointing the people that are going to hear the charges against executive branch agencies. And if we don't have some authority, and maybe it's not the Senate, but this is drafted as such, in the legislature, we've got the judge and the jury being the same people that are representing both ends, because they are the official voice of the agencies as the executive branch, and we've got them hearing the case. And to me, it removes a lot of the objectivity that would come as is going now through the regular court process.
Any other comments on the A1 amendment? I'll have to voice my concern about ceding powers to the people across the street as well. So,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Fabian.
Thank you. So to your comments and Jared Carlson's comments with regards to this amendment and ceding power to across the street, are there other, give me an example, Chair Carlson, of where the House of Representatives has any kind of oversight in terms of appointments by the executive branch. Are there things that we do here that gives us that oversight? I mean, when we talk about the PUC and commissioners and so forth, those are all, happening across the street.
Chair Carlson.
Chairman, we were talking about boards. I guess an example where both bodies confirm would be the Campaign Finance Board. That's one that comes to mind where you have the confirmation by both boards. But I do want to point out, Mr. Chairman, if I may, that the makeup of the board, and I can't speak to how the members are, whether they're confirmed or not, but the makeup of the board is modeled after many of the other states that we referenced, the 32 states out of the, what was it, 35, I think. So it's our process here is not on not uncommon in terms of the makeup of the board.
Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, two things. Can you, have you got a handout that shows me explicitly what other states do? You say it's similar, but I don't know what the definition of similar is.
Chair Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's been a few years since the legislation was originally drafted. What I was referencing at that time, when the different states and their processes were looked at, the makeup of the board, if I recall correctly, and I'm turning the clock back about 5-6 years, the makeup of the board was similar to what's done in other states. I would have to look back. I wasn't prepared to provide that detail of information because I thought that was a settled issue in terms of the makeup of the board from when we originally passed the bill.
Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I would appreciate that data. That would be helpful. And if it would calm the nerves of the chair and the chair, maybe you could do an oral amendment to have the House be involved in the confirmation of these members as well.
Mr. Chairman, if that was a question of me, I'd prefer to keep it in the same process we have in current law. So I would encourage, as I said earlier, a no vote.
Thank you. Again, I'll be reluctant to cede any powers to our friends across the street here, so I'll be encouraging no vote. All in favor say aye on the amendment.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. No ayes have it. We have an A2 amendment. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A2. And fortunately, it solves the issue that we just talked about. Because what this does is it puts the governor, the majority leader of the Senate, the speaker of the House, the minority leaders of each as the members. And they're, as so what this would do would, the appointment process in the respective bodies. And again, now what this does, of course, is to avoid that, what I call the separation of powers issue, as well as that unbiased opinion that we're now getting from the courts. So what this does is actually solve what we just discussed, because it does move the full power of the appointment back to the legislature, which ultimately, you know, some of these suits could get fairly large. And we would be expected, just like we've been expected in other areas, to appropriate money if indeed it has to be paid. So my concern again becomes that if we're going to be, if the potential exists that we're going to have to appropriate money, that we then should be in charge of deciding who is going to be on that board, and adding the unbiased opinion of people as well, because the legislature would be a separate arm from the governor's office where these agencies reside generally. That would be possibly the ones that the suit is being brought against. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I would again encourage a no vote, although this particular amendment doesn't totally move it across the street in terms of confirmation, but it does change the current makeup of the board, and that would change the board as it's currently constituted under current law, and I would prefer to stay with the way the bill was originally drafted and passed a few years ago. We're here mainly today for some housekeeping issues, as well as ultimately the appropriation, as I mentioned earlier, and so I'd like to keep the bill on track in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Vogel? Oh, Representative Devers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there members of the board right now?
Chair Carlson?
Yeah, in fact, to my left is the current chair of the board.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, and what has the board been doing since, was it 2014?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Blissenbach, would you care to respond?
Yes, the board is currently made up of, it has three members and two alternate members. There's one open alternate seat. Essentially what the board has been doing is we did go through the process of rulemaking, and we adopted the rules that were necessary for the operations when they when we're eventually in operation. The start date, the operation date of the board has been delayed a number of times. So we are waiting for the operations to be in play.
So, Representative Dedra?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And so have you been getting any requests to the board?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Ms. Blissenbach.
Members of the committee. We have not, because we have no jurisdiction currently. The delay in the initial legislation has meant that the jurisdiction has continued in the courts. So all unfair labor practices are currently being heard in district court and not by the board.
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Dittmer.
So you're saying that things have been in the courts then, and they've been dealt with by an unbiased judge? Is that what we're talking about? Usually that's the way it is in the courts.
Ms. Blissenbach?
Yes, members, or Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the process that is developed through this administrative process, really, this is a very specialized area of law, and most judges, they rarely see these ULPs. So we have a number that are filed, but it's very specialized, and what we have with this administrative process that has worked in 32 of the 35 states that recognize unfair labor practices is a body that has an expertise. Like in Wisconsin, they have the Wisconsin Employment Relations Committee. In Illinois, they have the PERC. In Florida, they have the PERC, Public Employment Relations Committee. And it is a committee that it has very extensive knowledge in the area of public sector labor law. And that is why the committee administrative process like this have been enacted in other states.
And Mr. Chair, just one last one.
Representative Dedmer.
You said there's been some filings. How many filings have there been?
Ms. Blissenbach?
I can't tell you exactly. The Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services would be able to do that, because all filings in court have to be copied to the commissioner. But I know of a couple that have been at least in the court system for over a year, some longer than that. It's a very expensive and timely process, and that is one of the reasons why an administrative agency to handle these specific areas of law has worked in other states, and we're hoping it will work here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Chair. Do you have an idea how much has been spent in the last 4 years?
Ms. Blissenbach?
I do not.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Okay.
Mr. Bond had perhaps on that issue, if it's all right.
Mr. Bond?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And to that question, so just to make it clear, in 2014, when the board was established and passed, there was funding that would allow them to begin promulgating rules and doing the very basic things that needed to be done to institute the board. But there was not operational funding. So there was not money to hire anyone to actually do the work of the board. Our coalition, after we passed it in 2014 and worked very hard to do that, in 2015 we came back and asked the legislature for the money, to appropriate the money, to actually operate the board. And unfortunately, that was never appropriated. We came back in 2016 and asked again. We came in 2017 and asked, and it has not been appropriated yet. So that's why the resources that are included in Representative Carlson's bill are so important, so that we can actually operate the board, because currently the board does not operate.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Blissenbach, I'm sorry if I got your name wrong. I apologize. So you said something about you haven't been able to do the work or something because of some data practices violations or whatever. Can you explain those to me?
Ms. Blissenbach.
Chapter 13.
There are no data practices violations. What this bill would do is classify the data that is in the hands of the board under the Data Practices Act. So just like the Board of Nursing has specific data classifications under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, this bill would have classifications for all of the data that is turned over during the investigation process of unfair labor practices, that is introduced into a hearing over an unfair labor practice, maybe that's put into briefing to the board, or, you know, it makes up the record of the case when it's in front of the board. This bill would deal with how that data is classified. So there's not a data violation. It's just classifying the data that is in the hands of the board.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then comments have been made about the current process that we have is very costly. How much has been spent in the past 4 years, I'll say litigating claims that have been brought forward on both sides of the claim?
Ms. Blissenbach.
That would, I mean, we would have to ask the individual parties that have been in cases in district court. And so that number is not, I mean, I don't believe is knowable without reaching out and asking the attorney's fees, the court filing costs, the cost to the court for having additional caseload. So I do not know the answer to that question.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, how many cases have there been?
Ms. Blissenbach.
As I mentioned earlier, the Commissioner of Mediation Services would be able to give a better answer to that, because they have to be notified of all cases that are unfair labor practice cases that are filed. I am aware of a number of them that have been in the courts for over a year, but other than that, I don't have specifics.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone here from the Board of Mediation Services?
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Carlson.
Just a little bit of history on that. You know, I'm here today mainly for the appropriation in the end, which will be resolved in ways and means. But Bureau of Mediation Services testified for the bill when it was originally passed. And if I recall correctly, both sides at that point argued that this would be more efficient, more expertise, because they would be accustomed to dealing with these kinds of issues, and they felt that it would be less expensive than going through the courts.
Thank
and that
you.
Was done in 2014. And what we're really here for today is the operational dollars to, you know, the rulemaking has been done, and unfortunately it's been delayed due to the lack of operational dollars, and hopefully at the conclusion of this session we will have been able to provide those operational dollars.
So, okay. We're still on the A2 amendment. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the discussion, because this is rather complicated in ways, and the data practices probably is an issue that may need to be discussed. But I get back to that we could have an appropriation. If we're not going to have representation on that board from the legislature, we may end up appropriating money relative to what's being decided by this board. And that's the reason for this amendment, is to say, fine, have the board, but the board be appointed by the legislature so that if indeed there are settlements and if indeed the money has to be appropriated to pay any outcomes of those, that it originated with dual control, basically the governor's office, the executive branch, and the legislature, and that's the purpose for this amendment, and that's why I believe that we should adopt it, and it does include both chambers of the House and the Senate, where the money would have to be appropriated. So that's the key for this amendment, rather than the as it exists now, with the executive branch appointing the people that are going to make the decision, that are going to spend the money that the legislature needs to appropriate.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Any response?
I think I gave my response earlier, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Carlson, can I ask you a question? At the end of session, we usually have housekeeping bills where payouts on claims against the state are settled and appropriations are made, and it's always passed by the House and the Senate. That gives me some comfort that both bodies do have oversight as far as any payouts. Am I correct in thinking that way?
I would concur.
Well, thank you. That's any further discussion on the A2? Okay. I will not be supporting this, but all in favor of the A2 amendment, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the does not prevail. The motion does not prevail. So 769. Back to the bill itself and in the original form.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and then summary then, there is housekeeping language in the bill, but in addition to that, the main thrust in the end is to get them the funds that they need for operational purposes. The bill does have a few other stops. The motion before you is that it be referred to government op. It'll go from government op to ways and means, and then it'll go to I think it's the Judiciary Division where they deal with data practices. So just like in 2014, the bill made several stops, and it looks like we're going to be tracking much the same way again this time.
Any further discussion on the bill? Any questions to the author? Anyone in the audience that would like to weigh in? Okay, hearing none. And we've had final comments. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 769 be referred to the Government Operations Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Motion passes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Next on the agenda is House File 295. And I will move that House File 295 be re-referred to Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. Representative Davney, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to present House File 295. You know, last evening, Mr. Chair, I was at the office here working with staff on a project until a little on the light side, and then had a meeting with some advocates who are constituents who wanted to discuss a bill that will be receiving a hearing next week in another committee. And we decided that it should be kind of an informal conversation about the legislature and strategy and the like. So went to one of the fine establishments in my district. Food was eaten, beverages were consumed. At the end of the evening, the waitress divvied up the bill three ways. I paid my bill with a credit card because, you know, as I was leaving the house office building last night to go to this meeting, I realized I'd spent my last $2 for a cup of coffee at the Mindot Cafe earlier that day. So I quick ran down to the ATM on the ground floor by the the tunnel over to MnDOT, and it wasn't working. It was out of order. So I had no cash. So when the waitress divvied up the bill and I received my part, I pulled out my credit card and gave her a $4 tip, and off it went. All good. Now, I would expect, and I think you would expect, that the waitress would get $4 of that $4 tip. If I'd paid in cash, she'd receive $4 of that $4 tip. But in Minnesota, since I paid by credit card, her employer has the legal right to take from her tip to cover the routine business cost of the credit card transaction. I believe this is nothing short of wage theft. No one would expect an employer to have the right to go into the waitress's purse while she's working the floor and take money out of it. But in fact, that's essentially what we allow employers to do when they charge routine business cost of the credit card transaction against not their business, but the server or the bartender specifically. With me today is Wade Lindeberg, the Secretary Treasurer of Unite HERE, at least he was. Wade? Oh, good.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lindeberg, will you identify yourself and offer your testimony?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Wade Lindeberg. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Unite here, the hospitality union here in Minnesota, locally in the Twin Cities in Bloomington. We have about 6,000 members in 22 union hotels, our convention centers, all of our major sports venues, and 1,200 people on the field at MSP Airport. I'd like to thank Representative Dabney for bringing this bill forward, and today I'm hoping that you'll pass it through. Tips are the sole property of the direct service employee. That's a workplace posting from Dolly that goes up in all of the restaurants that I'm acquainted with. That is, in fact, a conflict in this situation and in the rules. Unite here believes that debit and credit card fees are the cost of doing business and for the business to pay. Our members and servers in general, organized or unorganized, also know and rely on tips and gratuities being the sole property of the server. Servers are paid only a minimum wage by their employer, and we believe that customers largely understand that. So tips become a contract between the customer and the server for the service provided. There's also an expectation from the customer that the server is getting the whole gratuity, whether delivered in cash or on credit cards. The server, a minimum wage earner, and the company's salesperson happens to be the one handling the physical transaction with the customer. Because the server had the bad luck of receiving a tip on a credit card that day, they're being penalized. Nowhere else in the operation of a bar, restaurant, sports venue, or an airport would a cook, a host, a steward be nicked for a credit card fee. I'll use my debit or credit cards a few times today to buy gas, groceries, or a new brush for my windshield today. Each time I have to assume there will be a charge to the business for swiping my card, but I'll have the confidence that they won't be able to assess a worker's earnings to pay for it. As consumers move more and more to plastic, there's no doubt that large industries like hospitality, retail, and other personal services should be negotiating with the financial industry for better terms on credit card charges. It's a structural problem in the system and one to be sorted out by industrial titans, not me, and not left to the person who brought me dinner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindeberg. Are there any other testifiers? We have one. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Ken Rockler, I'm a St. Paul resident. I've been involved both as an owner and representing the hospitality industry for years. I'm really here as a volunteer today. On this particular issue, I guess I feel as qualified as anybody. I am the reason why restaurants are deducting the credit card discount on tips. The law was in place before I was aware of it, but a little history of it's important to understand why this is a bill you should oppose. And that's around 2001, I don't remember, but I'm pretty sure it was either that or the year before, a couple of people I represented asked me about would they be allowed to forbid tipping on credit card charges. And I said, I don't know if you can or not. I said, let me check into it. I said, I don't think it'd be a very good move at that time. So I got in touch with Fair Labor Standards on this, and it turned out that there was a law on the books that had been there for three decades. It's federal also, by the way. This is not, when you call it wage theft, and it's happening everywhere in the United States. It's both federal and Minnesota state law. So they said, well, you can charge the server the commission or the discount on what they get paid as a tip at that point. I would also beg to differ on the comparison between a gas station attendant or a retail clerk. There, the entire fee is going to the establishment. Here, the restaurant is acting as an agent collecting the tip for the server at that point. Anyhow, I went back to them. I explained that they could do this, and it turned out it was so common that the leading point of sale systems already had it in their platform, and there's certain restrictions that you had to do in order to make it legal. But it's, like I say, it's done all over the United States. I think what's really important to know is what happened in 2000 and I want to say 5 or 6, there was a technical error on a bill, and this provision got taken out. Now, at the same time it got taken out, there were some things that labor did not want to have taken out that were erroneously deleted. Everybody agreed that it had been an error that they'd been deleted, but technically what was going on then was the use of the credit card discount was, we were advised by some that it was illegal. So I don't know if I should have done this or not, but I went to the first couple of members that I represented and I explained, you don't really have anything in place right now that makes this legal, but my suggestion is that you escrow the amount of the discount on the credit card tips in case this ruling goes against you. I didn't see how it would because it was acknowledged by the person at the Labor Department that made the error that it was an error. But some of them decided at that point to not take charge tips. And I don't think it lasted very long in all fairness. I think that most of them got enough grief from their customers at that point that they went back to it. But it's always that option. Today, I haven't been there for a few years. I tend to go to full-service restaurants. But if you go to Caribou Coffee or Panera, unless they've changed right now, they don't allow you to use a charge tip. So, again, I'm kind of worried about the law of unintended consequences. I'm trying not to mix two issues, but to give you some idea of why this is so vital to maintain. Do you all have this handout that I think... If you look at the back of it briefly, you'll say that the closest state to Minnesota in terms of what our tipped employees receive is Illinois. We are currently 199% of Illinois. That's the 16 states that we're in the region that are closest to us. They didn't skip any. There's no cherry picking there. It goes all the way up to, if you get down to those that are involved in the federal law, there's five of them that we're 462% of. Wisconsin, we're 423% of. So, again, I'm mixing two subjects, you might say, but the problem we have is what does this mean to the individual restaurant and what does it mean to the individual employee? I put in there an example of what it means. If you assume that there were $500,000 in charge tips at an average of 2.3% discount at an establishment, that employer would be paying $11,500 per year more than they are right now. What does that mean to an employee? If you assume 1,500 hours with $10 per hour of charged tips, and normally the opposition tells me that doesn't really occur, but let's use that as an example, $10 an hour of charged tips, there is a discount factor that would equal $345 a year that the employee would continue to have taken out of their charged tips. But if you ask the vast majority of employees if they would prefer to be paying that discount or whether they would want to have people not allow charging of the tips, I think I would know what the answer is, and I think most of you would also. Finally, this is just part of an overall trend right now. If anybody's been to McDonald's recently, I drove out to Eagan. They not only have kiosks right now because they're trying to get rid of live employees because of the cost of employment right now, and I'm not necessarily in favor of that. I've testified before this committee many a time in favor of raising the minimum wage. But now they're offering a discount if you order and bypass the human beings. That's how anxious they are to do this right now. What's going on right now is very real. If you go to Olive Garden right now, they've eliminated 60% of their servers. They still have kept some of them, but they have iPads on each table. Country clubs for 100 years have taken the entire amount in a service charge rather than a gratuity. So I have a funny feeling I know how this vote is going to go already, but I really urge you to think again about the law of unintended consequences. And my last anecdotal thing is that friends of mine own part of a Chick-fil-A out in St. Louis Park. It's actually the widow of my partner. So we would drive out there occasionally. I live in St. Paul. I wonder why they didn't have an ATM machine there, because they go through so much volume at those places. And he said, well, we're actually trying to get rid of cash. I said, why would you want to get rid of cash and pay the credit card discount, the whole discount? I'm not talking about a gratuity because there's not much there. They said, because we'd rather pay that, because if we can save the cost of a couple of employees, it's worth our paying 2-something percent. That's on millions of dollars of volume. So again, if there was no such thing as price-volume relationship, that might be fine, but unfortunately that's not true. So I would urge you to oppose this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rockler. Any other public testimony? Questions to the author? Representative Kegel?
I'm sorry, not to the author. Okay. I'd like to request a roll call, though, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jung?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dammel, I'm just curious, is there like a standard percentage that credit card company charges, or does it vary from credit card companies to credit card companies?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zhuang. It does vary some by credit card companies. You may notice there's still some pattern of some places not accepting American Express. It's because they assess a higher transaction fee. A couple of percent would be a guideline.
Any other comments, questions?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. So, any Mr. further Chair. Discussion? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, you know that this is going on. If you're like me, you actually add a little bit to your tip because you probably suspect that, there's going to be a fee and there's a way around this. I commented last week about how hard it is to keep the doors open in many restaurants and small towns in rural Minnesota. They're closing too frequently. And I just feel that these small businesses who really treasure their employees need a little break once in a while too. And the credit card fees, when I'm in Roseau, I seldom use a credit card because I know that there are fees attached to it. And I just think that at some point we have to recognize how hard small town cafes, the owners work, how much they care about their employees. And I just don't want to go down this road. I think it's one more thing that's going to lead us towards kiosks and fewer employees and those types of things too. So Mr. Rockler talked about some unintended consequences, and I kind of can get my head around that, especially when you live where I live and you know how hard people are working just to keep the doors open. What kind of a response do you have to those concerns?
Chair Devney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Fabian, it is hard to run a small business. It's hard to run the hardware store in town. It's hard to run the drug store in town. It's hard to run the dry cleaner in town. But none of those businesses take money out of their employees' pockets if I pay by a credit card. Only restaurants and bars, only those in the hospitality industry are allowed to catch a break by taking from their employees. I think a break may be deserved. The restaurant business, as Mr. Rockler can tell you, is a very challenging business. 4 out of 5 restaurants close their first year. It's not because they're paying transaction fees on credit cards. It's more complex than that. But I started in high school working in restaurants, started washing dishes. I wasn't charged the cost of the dish detergent. I went on and got into some nicer restaurants where I had to buy my own equipment, my own knives and things like that. The pots and pans were provided by the restaurant. And when I left that line of work, I was able to take those knives and the like with me. In fact, I still use some of them at home. So, sure, being a small business is hard, but it shouldn't be borne on the backs of the employees.
Representative Fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wish that we had some empathy for the employees, especially the ones in small towns like in Badger and Greenbush and Carlstead, for the employers, excuse me. I do have a tremendous amount of empathy for the employees. They're my neighbors, my friends, and so forth. And quite frankly, none of my neighbors and friends who do this kind of work have talked to me about this issue. And I just wish that we had some empathy for the small town employers who, again, members are struggling to keep their doors open, and that is a reality. And I just don't see much of that.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the history on this, I believe it was Chair Rukavina, the Labor Chair Rukavina and the Dolly Commissioner back in about 2011, that actually said that this was taken out as a mistake and it was fixed in the revisor's bill. Curious if nonpartisan staff might have some knowledge of that since it was brought up.
Mr. Weeks, any input?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, in 2010, in the Department of Labor and Industry policy omnibus, all of the rules under 5200.0080 were repealed. They were listed by the Department of Labor and Industry Commissioner at the time, who was Steve Swigum, who thought they were no longer necessary. That was an error. All but 2 were put back into law in the revisor's bill in the following year in 2011. So this was this provision that's being repealed in this bill, 5200.0080 subpart 7, was out for a year in 2010 and then back in 2011.
Representative Vogel.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So the bottom line is, you know, back in 2011, there was a bipartisan concern that this should remain in there, and the letter was written to keep it there. And I think that carries some weight because it wasn't just a partisan thing. It was actually a bipartisan thing, recognizing that this is an infringement on businesses trying to get through things. I do agree that if you're using a credit card, you tend to tip more than if you're not. It's a lot easier to write down $5 than it is to pull out $5 out of the billfold, and that's why credit cards and debit cards are an advantage when you're getting a tip, because I do think you get a larger tip. And therefore, yes, there is a charge for that, but if you're getting a 5% larger tip and you get dinged 1 or 2% for the charge, you're still a few percentages ahead. And if indeed all of a sudden the businesses decide that, you know what, we're getting close here, we have to do something, and they don't allow the tip anymore on the credit card and they go to cash, I think the servers are going to take the hit. So I agree with this idea of unintended consequences, because I don't think we realize how much more is paid in tips when a card is used than when it's not used. I realize more of a comment than a question, but I would be interested if anybody else feels that they don't tip just a little bit more when they don't actually have to pull those green things out of a billfold, or they don't have the green things in the billfold in the first place because the cash machine didn't work.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel is right. People do tend to spend more when they're using a credit card. I think that's an interesting observation, but it has nothing to do with the essence of the bill, which is, should the employer be able to nick the tip intended for the server because of the way I choose to pay the tip? I do know that Representative Rukavina was proud that he always left tips in cash.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would contend that the merchant isn't making any money on this. When the merchant submits their $100 credit card, they only get $98 in their bank account. So this isn't like the merchant, or the in this case the restaurant, is making extra money. If indeed the discount was 2% and the merchant was nicking them for 4%, now that's obviously wrong and that's wage theft. But the merchant is only getting, if the bill is $100, the merchant is only getting the $98 or whatever that discount is. So this is not the merchant making any more money. This is just the merchant and the employee sharing the cost of what it of the transaction itself, and the transaction probably netting a little more for both of them. Because I know myself, I'm more inclined to spend a little more if I don't have to pull it out of the wallet. And all this is saying is, look, let's share in the increased profit that we're getting as a result of using this card.
Those are interesting comments from a fiscal conservative.
I'm a wild and crazy guy.
Thank you. Any further comments? Any further testimony from the public? One more. Please. Identify yourself and proceed.
Ken Rockler, 456 Ashland, St. Paul. Just a point of clarification, Chairman Sundin and members of the committee. The discount, there's a $100 charge. The discount, let's say it's that 2.3% that we discussed earlier as an average, that doesn't come out of the server, the 2.3% there. If there is a $20 tip on that, it's only the tip that the percentage comes out of. I just wasn't sure that was clear to everybody on that. So if you had a $20 tip on a $100 tab, let's see, my math isn't that good these days. 1% of $20 would be 20 cents, so 2 would be 40. So there'd be about 46 cents out of that $20 tip at that point. It's not the entire amount of the tab. That was the only point I wanted to clarify on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rockner. Any further testimony? Questions to the author? Okay. There's been a roll call requested, and I will say that I fully intend I fully appreciate the intentions of the author on this bill. And Mr. Jorgensen will take the roll. Okay. The motion again is we're on 295 be referred to Ways and Means. We have the bill. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Vogel, or Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Vogel. Representative Claflin.
Aye.
Representative Detmer. Representative Fabian.
No.
Representative Hornstein. Representative Lippert.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Yes. Representative Purcell?
Aye.
Representative Jean?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-4. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda is House File 905. Representative Cagle will move that House File 905 be re-referred to Ways and Means. We have the bill before us. Representative Cagle, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm really excited about this bill. This is the Getting to Work bill. As we know, reliable vehicles are critical to the success of most working families. Car ownership enables people to access better jobs, work more hours, transport their children to and from school and childcare, take care of family needs, get to grocery stores, medical appointments, all that kind of that good stuff. And this is a program I'm very familiar with. I used to work at the Community Action Program here in Washington, Ramsey Counties. And one of my former colleagues, Alba, is here with us to talk about the program. And my desk actually was right next to where a lot of the people who had the car loans would come in and pay their car loans. And so I got to see a lot of these folks that were coming in and just the pride they took in having, you know, building the credit, having that that car, and then also being able to, you know, transport their families around and get to work. So with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, who would like to go first?
I will, Mr. Chair, if that's all right.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We're a statewide coalition of nonprofit organizations working directly with Minnesota families who are facing financial challenges. We're very grateful to Representative Cagle for her leadership on the Getting to Work bill, because we know from our conversations with thousands of Minnesota families that the lack of transportation options is a workforce barrier for many low-income families that's serious and is pervasive. The fact is that workers without a vehicle are at a significant disadvantage in the job market, especially in areas of the state where public transportation is limited, but also if they work second or third shift or need to bring children to childcare on their way to work. The Getting to Work program provides funding through a competitive grant process administered by DEED to nonprofit organizations that offer low-interest car loans or leases, affordable car repairs, or donated vehicles to families who need a car to get to work. Most of you probably know there are already a handful of fantastic programs around the state that do offer these services. Programs partner with auto dealerships, auto service providers, banks and credit unions, churches and civic organizations that want to invest in their communities and that believe that when someone has a will to work, there needs to be a way to get there. The purpose of the Getting to Work program is to expand successful nonprofit vehicle programs and to launch new programs in areas of the state where nobody is offering those services and they could make a big difference. Just to give you a little background on the bill, and then I'll walk through a couple of the policy points. The legislature created the Getting to Work program in 2017 with a one-time appropriation. Six organizations received grants from that appropriation, and you'll hear from one of them today. The DEED has already released a progress report on the program that shows that those six programs are making a big difference in their community. Of the families who received services from those six programs, 26% report that the vehicle or vehicle repair that they received enabled them to take a new job. 77% reported it enabled them to keep a job that they had, and 50% reported it enabled them to increase their earnings. Those six programs, I just want to clarify, aren't cookie-cutter programs. Each model has evolved to meet the needs in their community. For instance, the Helping People Get There program at United Community Action, which serves South Central Minnesota, takes referrals directly from their local workforce center of people currently receiving public assistance and who have a job offer but who need a vehicle to take that job. A different program, a program at the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, offers sliding scale vehicle repairs for lower income families who need their vehicle to get to work. It's clearly not just Greater Minnesota where there's a demand for these services. I was recently talking to the Workforce Engagement Coordinator at Emerge, which is a North Minneapolis nonprofit, and she explained that her job is to help prepare clients to work in manufacturing because those are jobs that are available and good paying. But the biggest barrier for her clients is that most of those jobs are out in the suburbs or beyond. She said she talks to employers who have vacancies for second or third shifts that they can't fill because it's after the buses stop running.
She has clients who would take those jobs if they had a vehicle to get to work. Community Action of Hennepin County, which also serves that area, received one of the Getting to Work grants. They delayed the launch of their program due to some staff transition, but I am happy to let you know they have now served 11 families, helping those families get on the road to work, and they have a waiting list of 135 eligible families who have asked for help with a vehicle. We have some testifiers here to tell you about one of the other programs, so I want to just briefly call your attention to a couple of policy points in the bill. Section 1, Subdivision 3 defines the program requirements. In addition to providing vehicle or vehicle repairs, eligible programs need to offer an educational component that can be budgeting for vehicle ownership or instruction for car maintenance and repair or financial literacy. Subdivision 4 requires organizations applying for the funding to have a plan for leveraging matching funds from the community, as existing programs already do. And Subdivision 5 includes eligibility criteria for the participants. That includes income guidelines, a requirement that participants have a valid driver's license and insurance, and that they demonstrate they need the vehicle to obtain or maintain employment. I would like to introduce Elba Castillo from the Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties to talk about the program that she runs.
Elba Castillo, would you please state your name and proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Elba Castillo. I am a financial service coordinator for Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. Community Action is a nonprofit agency working to reduce the causes of poverty and its impact on people's lives in our community. I manage the Car Ownership Loan Program, which was established by a grant from the McKnight Foundation more than 30 years ago. This is a revolving loan pool. This program provides a $6,000 car loan to families who are at or below the 200% of the federal poverty guidelines and are in need of reliable transportation to maintain their jobs and improve their economic stability. While the Car Ownership Loan Program provides a greatly needed resource for low-income families, prior to getting to work funds, we had a major gap in our service. Many of those families struggle to make needed repairs to their vehicles, often choosing between meeting their basic needs and driving a bad car needing new tires or brakes. Because of the Get Into Work funds, we were able to help fill this gap by offering a $500 vehicle repair grant. So far, we have helped 33 families make needed repairs, ensuring safety and extending the life of the vehicle. We plan to help another 12 families with the remaining funds we have available. There are many stories that I can share with you today, but one in particular stands out. This participant received a repair estimate of $800, much more than she could afford. The steering wheel was locking while she was driving, and the brake pads and rotors needed to be replaced, both, of course, a huge safety risk. A household of five, and the participant was the primary earner of her family, and as a personal care attendant, the vehicle was necessary for her to keep her job. Because of this grant, and also working with local partners that we work with, whether it's dealerships or auto repair shops, they help her with the 15% discount and gave her the 15% discount by AutoMax, which is one of our partners. She was able to repair her vehicle without falling behind on her rent and maintain her employment. Without these funds, her story would have been ended differently and likely resulted in financial crisis for the family. And today as well, we have another participant of this grant who's here with us to share her story, Jacqueline Arias. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jacqueline Arias. I wanted to share my story of how I got involved with Community Action's Car Loan and Repair Program.
Could you move that microphone a little closer to your mouth? Thank you.
I had been working with Neighborhood Development Alliance, NEDA, for housing counseling for the past couple of years. When my vehicle was going out in the beginning of 2018, I talked with my NEDA counselor, and she gave me some information on Community Action's Car Loan Repair Program. Since I was not in the position financially to go out and purchase a new vehicle, I had tried to get a loan at my bank because I had been building my credit, but they said it was too soon and I would need to show at least a year of good credit. When my vehicle finally went out, I decided to call Community Action. I went through the steps of the program, including the financial literacy training, where I learned about things like budgeting, debt reduction, and building good credit. Then I finally purchased my vehicle for $5,800. It was such a blessing to me and my family since we are unable to get to work and school without a vehicle. Excuse me. I work in St. Paul and start at 6 a.m. On my lunch, I go home and get my grandson to take him to school in West St. Paul and then drop my daughter off at work in Woodbury. I don't know if buses even run that early in the morning. So again, this program was such a blessing. So 3 months after I purchased the vehicle, the wheel bearing went bad. I took the vehicle to the dealership and they said it would be $500 to repair. They also advised that we stop driving the vehicle immediately because it was not safe to drive like that. I was so worried about how we were going to fix it as we did not have that much money on hand and we couldn't afford to miss work. All of a sudden, I remembered that Community Action had also had funding available for vehicle purchasers after you had made your third payment for any repairs that you might need. I just so happened to have made my third payment and I called Community Action right away. I brought the vehicle to one of the shops on their recommended list, and after they approved the repair, I was able to get my vehicle in right away. The next day I picked up my vehicle and was back on the road. I cannot thank Elba, sorry, and Community Action enough for all their assistance that they provided. I'm very grateful for this program and I hope that it continues to get funding in order to help others who are in the same position that I was, because it was a great program. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further testimony from the public? Questions to the author? Good. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got the report here, and I noticed that there's provision of a motor vehicle and motor vehicle repairs, but there weren't any loans made, and I can empathize with the situation of trying to build credit, and I'm curious if I would assume that's part of the program. What might be done in that area, because it isn't always about just coming up with a down payment, as you know. It's the learning how to make the payments and to build that credit so that the next time you get to maybe do it on your own. And since there wasn't any made, I'm wondering if that's an intent going forward to try to enhance that, or if indeed there's other agencies that are doing it, because I do think that's a valuable part of this program is not only helping people into the vehicles, but helping them to sustain a vehicle, whether it's repairs or payments or whatever.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
I can answer part to that question. The car ownership loan program does require participants to complete a financial literacy class, which teaches them how to understand the financial world, how to build your credit, what to do, when not to do. And at the same time, the program as a case management during the whole term of the loan, they are under supervision to a certain extent to maintain a budget. And if they are falling behind or if we start noticing that payments are getting into the office but not the minimum required, then we will contact this family and try to see what may be happening at home to help them not to go that route. And they also, along with that, is they learn what other different ways that you can build your credit so that when you are off this program, your credit is actually in good standing, how to maintain it, and you know, so that if in the future they pursue something else in their financial goals, like getting a house, that has been something that they learn how to maintain.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Vogel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question then is, there wasn't any made last time. Is that something that you would intend to probably look at, or is it outside the parameters and something that maybe somebody else is doing, or that the need is such in the area of repairs that there just isn't going to be happening.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you. If it's okay, I would like to try to address that. There were many programs that applied for these funds, and I know that some of them intended to launch loan programs. Some of them, like the CAP of Ramsey and Washington, already had a loan program and used the funding to expand into repairs. The original appropriation was $100,000 per year for those grants. We had asked for a little more, and part of the reason I believe that the programs that got launched with this specific funding were primarily repair programs is that they went out as fairly small grants to the organizations, and it simply takes a little more funding up front to provide the capital to do the loan programs like the Cap of Ramsey and Washington does. What we're hoping this time, because the bill clearly authorizes the use of that funding for repairs, to fix up donated vehicles, or for the kind of low-interest auto loans that Cap of Ramsey and Washington does. We're hoping with a little additional funding, if DEED is able to put out grants at a little bit of a larger level for organizations, they can use that to begin that revolving loan pool, which I know Cap of Ramsey and Washington did with, I believe, funding from the McKnight Foundation several years back. But so it'll take a little bit larger grant to get some of those loan programs going, but then, of course, those will be more sustainable programs because those funds will revolve back into the loan program. So we're hopeful that some of those might get launched in the second round of grants.
Thank you, Representative Vogel.
Thank you.
I have a question for the testifiers or the author. There was reference to the repairs done by shops that are on a list, or a preferred list. These repairs that are done, I guess they're emergency repairs. These people on the list, how do you get on that list? It sounds like you've got a captive audience of customers here if you're on that list. And do they give you a little bit of a discount for bringing customers to them?
Mr. Chair, actually we have done a lot of work of building our partnership with the private sector. And part of it, for us, there's really, other than us having a reference place to go to, a place who is registering the Business Bureau to make sure that where we're sending our participants is the right place. They do offer discounts to participants. In this particular case, the one that stands out for me, it was perfect because it was 15% of a discount that usually any other place will. They're running a business. They most likely will give some sort of a discount, but that will not go that route. But because we have done businesses with them for a long time, they are willing to do this for the participants, as well as a lot of the time, if it's not giving them a discount, they'll give the parts at cost. So they're not making money off of them in that sense, but they, of course, they have to keep the business running. So it's kind of a two and two. We help the participants, but then at the same time, Community Action has a reliable place for us to send either for participants purchase a vehicle or get repairs done through the car ownership, car repair program.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Would the author like to renew the motion that House File 905 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.